laboratory. What seems to happen is they report it when they get into the real world and they try to do as best they can. Don't forget, the symbol is what, 81 nanoseconds or 92 nanoseconds. Any little bit of impulse stuff that happens, it blows the whole thing away. So, you would expect with both antennas, you would get the impulse into both antennas, and it should cancel itself out. The story is, it's a bit more problematic. And, you know, in the analog world, you didn't really have to care about the whole 6 megahertz. You were really more concerned about 15 kilohertz and 230 kilohertz and 900 kilohertz up from the bottom of the stutter band. Those are the noticeable places. HRW K3J.
Yeah, when you read the Spagnoli reports, the main guy who had a lot to do with the engineering of the advanced television techniques that we're now using, digital television, it becomes pretty obvious to me reading it that he recognized the fact that impulse noise on a digital system creates a huge vulnerability that analog didn't have. Analog, when you're watching Channel 2 and somebody's running a noisy ignition system on a lawnmower, you got a bunch of streaks across the picture, but it was tolerable. With digital, it loses sync and all things break up. And as such, because impulse noise of ignition systems, for instance, and honking of transformers and power lines, because it usually falls off 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency, that, in my opinion, is the main reason why the vast majority of digital television is UHF and very little of it is VHF by comparison. There are a few channels in a few metro areas that, for traditional reasons, are sticking with VHF, you know, channels 2 through 6, lower VHF, but boy, are they suffering. 7 through 13 is quite a bit better off, and the UHF channels from 14 and above are much better off on this vulnerability of impulse noise. Let me drop. An occult channel interference system would be very good at rejecting impulse noise coming from the undesirable direction. It's a very narrow window. All other directions, the impulse noise is not going to cancel. It's going to come roaring through, and as such, that vulnerability is going to be there. If you're at a low enough frequency where the impulse noise is going to hurt you, it's going to hurt. Because of the change in conditions of Mother Nature's propagation, I can see that just manually setting the best null on your canceller is very good today, but an hour from now or a day from now, it's not going to be so good. You and I could design, Eric, an automatic gain control circuit, in other words, an automatic steering network. We could create an intelligent network that does the fine amount of tweaking in order to keep the bit error rate as low as possible. You and I could design a circuit to do that. So as long as you have a known one or two directions of undesirable signals, I think 98% of the time we could reject them and make the system fly. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2EJ. I agree with you. Actually, the receiver technology has gotten considerable. There's more new stuff coming out, but now we're talking about ATSC 3.0. We're on 2.0 now. 3.0, they're still having an argument in terms of making it a compatible system. By the way, COFDM is not as affected by impulse noise like ATSC is. You've got to consider COFDM as being a different technique. Where instead of transmitting one carry, you're transmitting like a thousand carries, and you have duplication of the actual data information. No other problems with it. It takes a heck of a lot more power, uses a lot more, it's the same coverage area that we get now with digital television with ATSC. Things more bigger transmitters, you know, bigger electric bills, so why we didn't go that way in the first place. But yeah, no, I agree with you, Dick, and there are ways, you know, if you want to throw money at something, I'm sure we could come up with something that's really fantastic, but then you have to take that and turn it into something that is part of every TV station. HRIWK, 2K.
There's a couple of questions I want to ask you, Eric. Of all the questions we get on the TechNet, whenever we get into over-the-air television broadcast, we get a lot of response from people who want to know more about it. So I've got a couple of questions for you. Let's see what the Hal's got to say, and then I'm going to go over to those questions. K6DPZ, KQRIW, go ahead, Al.
KQRIW, the check now, K6. I have an appointment at 9:30. I have to speak. I'd like to go over the project which I'm presenting, my mark. But if your stuff is more important, then I will just forget it and go next week.
Let's find out if Eric can hang in there. Eric, with those questions, are you going to be here about 20 minutes from now? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No problem, then. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay, Hal. Hal, we have just carved out a window for you to make your presentation. And so I know you'd like to sell it to all of the membership as well as the leaders of Limark. Have at it. Let's see how well they love your group project. K6DPZ, his presentation. K2RIW, the tech man.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Eric. Okay, I have come up with a receiver and a transmitter that very easily, each of the units utilizes only one tube. The transmitter utilizes a 6AQ5, the receiver utilizes a 6U8. I chose to make two separate pieces because a lot of you fellows have receivers. You don't need a transceiver. For somebody who wants a transceiver, the transmitter and the receiver separately. The transmitter works on 80 and 40 meters, utilizing a 3.58 color burst crystal. By utilizing the 3.58 color burst crystal, straight through on 80 and it doubles on 40. So you got about 7.160 on 40 meters with CW frequency, 0.58 with the CW frequency on 80. It's a very straightforward, simple design. One tube, it utilizes the transformer, so you're not going hot off the line. Puts out between 4 and 7 watts. So very easily, I'm going to propose to Limark or possibly to make a board, and you just have to fill the board and take off with it. I did a breadboarding on it, and I'm going to let a couple people at Limark, I'm going to submit diagrams, layouts, and everything, let them build it on the board, and if they feel it's interesting enough, as a club project, I'll relinquish all my rights to be able to build it. Now, on the receiver, it's very unique. It's a tube receiver using 8. It's a redundant detector. And the tetrode section is used as a detector. The triode section is used as a cathode follower output. The reason why I did this, most headphones today are not 2,000 ohm impedance. By using cathode follower output to the headphones, first of all, you got a wide range of impedance from
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hal, we lost the last 3 minutes because that was a 5-minute transmission. You might want to repeat the last 3 minutes. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Hal, we heard up to the point where you were describing the 6U8 cathode follower output to the headphones. Heard nothing after that. KC2WGB.
I wish I would have recorded it. KC2WGB and K5WK. Okay, as I'm explaining, the receiver Q8 is a rejector, and normally on most regenerative receiver headphones in the plate circuit is high impedance. I chose not to do that for safety. Going in from the 6U8 tetrode and cathode follower, which is all in one tube, the impedance coming out is between 800 and 500 ohms for some very cheap headphones, and it's total isolation where you don't have high voltage on the phones for safety. The interesting part about it is the tuning system, using a permeability tuned system in the receiver. And the way it works, well, let me reset. I don't want to get lost on this again. So I'm going to knock off that timer. Okay, the way it works, imagine a half inch diameter, about 3/8 inch diameter slug tuned coil with a powdered iron slug that's moving in and out of the coil. Well, this coil against a fixed capacitor tuned between 3 and 8 megahertz that will cover your 80 to 40 meter band. Now, on that screw that's coming out from the slug, imagine a round disc. Round disc, and then has a knob at the end of that. Now imagine the disc drawing a line from the center of the disc, circularly going out, larger, larger, and larger. That is the scale. So when you turn the receiver's dial, the scale is calibrated, and that's how you get your frequency readout and vernier tuning. Okay, I think I covered everything. Dick, I'll turn it over to you or John, and now we gotta see if there's an interest. If there's no interest, I'll throw it in the circular file, K6DP3.
Hal, you called it a regen receiver. I wonder if it is or could it be a super regen receiver, because therefore with one tube as the receiver you get a whole lot of simultaneous RF gain, detection, and audio gain all in that one tube. That's question number one. Question number two is that those particular tubes, 6AQ5 and 6U8, famous old-fashioned tubes, been around for 60 years, and nowadays students think, at least they've been told, they've been programmed to think that the whole world has gone solid state, and old-fashioned vacuum devices, thermionic emission devices, are the older technology. And so selling it from that point of view is going to have a little bit of a difficulty, I think. So you might want to approach those two areas first, Hal. K6DPZ, K2LIW, trying to behave as a devil's advocate, and let's see how, if they hit you with those particular arguments, what your response is going to be. Over to you, Hal.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Okay, it is a regenerative, not super regenerative. Super regenerative utilizes a quenching circuit. This is a basic regenerative receiver. We maintain a very high sensitivity right where the threshold, where it goes into oscillation. And it can be under a half microvolt, which is phenomenal. As far as tubes, this is a basic approach to using a beam power pentode, a triode, and a tetrode. And for the circuitry involved to make it work, it's a good experiment tubes. You're not working with high voltages here. The transmitter utilizes about 320 volts on the plate. Screen grid's about 115. Receiver works at about 135 volt maximum. It's a very unique circuit on both pieces. I could have incorporated a transceiver, which I did in the past, but transceiver would bring the cost way up, where a separate little receiver and transmitter will keep the cost down. As I mentioned, if somebody just wants a QRP transmitter, CCW, it's beautiful. And if somebody wants just a little receiver to listen to QRP, it's beautiful. But you put them both together and you got a little station. Go ahead there, K2RIW, K6DPZ.
Now you may get a little bit of pushback on the subject of voltage, Hal. 325 volts on the transmitter, 115 volts on another one, 135 volts on another one. To you, those are low voltages. To you, high voltages, 850 volts that we put on a 6146, 750 volts, that's high voltage, I'll admit. Those are relative words. In the modern vernacular, where you want student safety, anything above 30 volts is considered not so safe. You might get a little pushback on that one. Second of all, when it comes to a circuit that runs on 3.579, 545 megahertz, that's an 80 meter CW band, or 7.15909, that's your 40 meter CW portion of the band, the second harmonic of that Coumadin's crystal, there are operational amplifiers that will operate at those frequencies. So to make the solid state would not make it expensive, but it could be solid state and have essentially the same performance at maybe even a slightly cheaper price. Yet you would still use that cam tuning mechanism you mentioned, the disc with the spiral, which I call a cam, which retracts the stalk. That exact same genius of a tuning mechanism could be used. But could it be made solid state with available up amps, so to speak? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. Yeah, I can design a solid state, but you wouldn't be able to get the power on it that this thing will put out. See, the high voltage is really a doubler. We're talking about maybe about 295 as far as the high voltage on the 685. You know, if somebody wants to experiment with a little equipment, this is the way to do it. You know, I could design a solid state unit too, but you only get maybe about 1.5 out of it. And it's all what the club wants to look at. You know, give me 10 more minutes, I'll put a carbon mic on it and make it AM.
Yeah, to use a tube in the receiver, in the modern day world, it's a little bit more difficult to justify as it giving you a great advantage. I will admit that the tube, as the transmitter, makes a one-tube transmitter, which can give you a significant number of watts of output. And to do that solid state, the op-amp can give you the drive, and another high-power transistor is required to give you the fancy output. You and I remember the Kenwood 590, for instance, among them. It's 520. Yeah, I'm looking at a Kenwood TS-520 right now. Just happens to be sitting on my shelf. It's a purely solid-state rig, except for the final tube, is 6146, and maybe the driver. So you can get the best mix of both worlds by using solid-state for the receiver and tube for the transmitter. And so using the 6U8 as a receiving tube as opposed to an op-amp, that's a little bit more difficult to justify. Is my first thinking on that. What does the tube buy you that an op-amp wouldn't buy you in that receiver circuit now? Yes, you're teaching people tube technology, but except for transmitters, tube technology, some people think is a bit passe these days. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
Sure, I'm presenting a project. Why don't we get a little input from some of the people on the tech net and see what their feelings are about it? I understand your feelings, Dick, but maybe we could throw it off for an open discussion, and then Limerock can look over the paperwork and decide if they want to make it into a project or not. I spent the time, but time is expendable. I don't care. I think we should throw it open and let the people make some comments. K2RW, K6DB.
I agree. We're going to do just that. So the open discussion right now for you guys to say yay or nay, you like, you don't like, what things should change. The two-tube transmitter, 6AQ5 and 6U8, regen receiver, and a single-tube transmitter with a crystal. The chrominance crystal to control it all on either the fundamental on 80 meter CW or second harmonic 40 meter CW. If you've got opinions as to whether or not it should be solid state all the way, solid state tube or all tube, and whether or not that would make a very good project for the younger generation of amateur radio operators in Lima, give us your feeling and subject right now. Tell me your call letters and your name, and we'll open it for discussion. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB with a comment.
John recognized. Anyone else?
Hey, you too, Joy.
Right now.
WB2GXM, Rich.
Okay, and Rich number two. WB2GXM. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
That's Suan, Paul.
We got Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we've only got five guys that want to discuss it. Here we go. John, you're number one on the runway. KC2, WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2, WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, I think we should, I work with these young boys and girls here, and I've seen what they're interested in. Hal's got a great idea. I think he's correct. The transmitter should remain tube-bound. But I think we should give him an option. Maybe he could sketch up a quick op-amp with maybe a little transistor for an amplifier, and he could make a receiver solid state and offer the tube also. So we would have two receivers, pick one that you want to build, and leave the transmitter alone. That's my recommendation. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I sort of like that. Very fine, John. Let's see what Eric's got to say. As you know, Eric has probably 40 years of research, 40 years of experience in the broadcast transmitting world, mostly television, but some of it radio, maybe 30% radio and the rest television. So Let's see what a broadcast engineer thinks about this. KE2EJ. K2IW.
Go ahead, Eric.
K2IW,
K3J. Oh, I think Al's got the right idea, but, you know, 300 volts is a little messy for people, and hard transformer. So you could actually make the receiver out of the new system. You only need 12 volts on the plate, so there you got one that's solid state, but it wasn't messy either. As far as building a transmitter goes, you know, you can very easily do solid state, do 10 watts, and lots of power blocks, even a grocery. Or you could be a little bit more innovative and do like a classy amplifier with a couple of really nasty switching transistors and 15, 20 watts. There are other ways to do it. I do see, I grew up on an educate which had a resistor line cord to make filament bulbs, okay? Transformer, forget it, that's plenty of rectifier and a nice big capacitor, and you build your tubes up, you know, your TRF radio or your 3-tube amplifier, and how old was I? I mean, 14, 13, 14, 15? No, I was younger, 10, there we go, when I got my education. So yeah, you can really get thrown across the room if you're not careful. In today's world, it's an interesting thing. Back to you, Dick.
CP0, fast comment.
Yeah, Hal specifically said the 300 volts is going to be developed by way of a voltage doubler. It doesn't have to be a transformer. That's the good news. But when you do it by voltage doubling, to get simultaneous isolation so that somebody doesn't make the chassis hot, you got to be a little bit careful. KE2EJ, I mean, K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
No, it can be done with just a 150 volts. There's no problem. I want to get a little more power out of the 6825, but we get about 3 watts working it with 150 volts still off an isolation transformer. So that's no problem, Dick. You know, a higher power output involves more B-plus voltage, but 150 volts will run the transmitter also at about 2.5-3 watts.
In your current design, Hal, is there an isolation transformer? If not, in the worst case, if the person mixes up the hot and the return of the 110-volt line, and the chassis happens to be considered the ground, and the chassis becomes hot with the 115, that does represent a little bit of a hazard. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
No, no, how do you look at it? 150 volts is still nasty.
You've got it both.
They both have isolation transformers, of course. No, I'm not going off the line. I'm using some very small transformers that are split winding, 110, 220, and they have 12-volt center tap on the output. So I'm taking one of the 110 windings, using the other one's isolated 110 winding, and 6 volts for the filament. I wouldn't put anything out to the club that would be a hazard. Believe me, I teach electronics. I know the rules.
Very fine. So you're talking about a transformer isolated voltage doubler circuit if you happen not to have 300 volts on the secondary. So where you said voltage doubler, quite often that's directly line fed on many of the circuits that we buy, and they use double insulation, plastic boxes, and so on. And the chassis is hot, but in theory you can't touch the chassis. And for homebrew, that would be difficult to justify. Okay, so that one has been settled. See what Rich has got to say about this. N2EO. Rich, I know that you and I, in the early days, cut our teeth on vacuum tubes. So we've got a warm, fuzzy feeling for vacuum tubes. N2EO, K2RIW.
Richard, before you take it, it can be made with 110 volts through an isolating transformer. The power of the transformer just will be less. The receiver is running on about 110 volts DC. But I want to get a little more soup out of the transmitter. That's why I went through a half-wave doubler with one common can that was common. So don't worry about that. There could be less power, and the low isolation transformers both receive and transmit separate units.
Okay, you thought about that, Hal. Let's see what Rich has got to say. N2EO, a two-man from way back. K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Jason, yes. I got my license in 1965. When I was 15 years old, solid state was barely coming in. I don't think that the 320 I've gotten shocks when I was in the servicing business like Al. Too late came here and got ill. And I used to service two radios. Many times I would get a shock off the 800 volt plate supply on 6146s. That really hurts. But even that didn't kill me. You know, I get, but on the voltages Hal was talking about, you put your hand away, but that's it. And think if you get a chance, I'd like to talk to you more about PRV1, if there's time. Yes, thank you.
A comment. The voltage I'm talking about, this whole setup, is the same as the American 5. How's that?
Yep, that's got a lot of history to it. And yes, I heard you, Rich. Next person is Rich number 2, WB2GXM. Those guys in Floral Park, they know tubes when they see them. You got it, Rich. WB2GXM, T2LIW.
Thank you. Well, we love the tubes in Floral Park. In fact, the tubes do not put me off, neither do the voltages. I was wondering, though, if the design will allow the transmitter to be used as, will allow the transmitter to accept an external ZFO input, WB2GXM.
I'm going to make a guess here and then turn it over to Hal, and that is to start off with that simple, very prevalent Chrominance crystal, 3.579545 crystal. That was the color television receiving frequency on all of our American televisions. There's umpteen million of those crystals around, and they're sold dirt cheap. So to start off with that very well-controlled crystal, giving you a very specific frequency on 80 meters CW and 40 meters CW, beautiful way to begin. As a later embodiment, where you now add a voltage frequency, a variable frequency oscillator to it, that's the next step after you fall in love with the way it works on that one fixed frequency. That's a guess on my part. Let's see what Hal's got to say. He's the designer. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, technically. Yeah, you can drive with a VFO. I just wanted to be cost-effective and figure using a colorless crystal, at least it would be on 40 and 80 meters. But you can drive a VFO in place of the crystal, and it'll work. But I figured it was easy to come up with something to be cheap and dirty.
Now, one quick question for you, Hal. At one time, the novice exam allowed you to operate in the novice frequency band with Morse code if it was crystal controlled. I think that rule went away. I think your tech license these days, which is the equivalent of the novice exam, I think nowadays with frequency controlled phase lock loop systems, I don't think anything, well, you could say that that's crystal controlled. So this crystal controlled versus VFO, I think that restriction has essentially gone away. Is that true, Hal? Over you, Hal, K2RIW.
Correct, Dick. Got it, Hal.
Yeah, I think it did. But see, one thing I was thinking when I came up with this whole idea as a club project, and it can run with no voltage doubler, just straight through, it won't put out as much power in the transmitter, but it can be low power. You know, 3 watts. If it's got a color burst crystal, then all the guys that are involved in QRP and members of Limark know they can all meet on the same frequency. That was part of my thinking as a club project. Go ahead, Dick.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, the person saying comment, you're going to be right after Paul, WS2N. One thing that you've already said, Hal, is that this is going to be transformer isolated. That makes it safe. And the secondary winding is either going to be used straight through or as a voltage doubler, depending on whether you build a high voltage or slightly higher power transmitter or not. This transformer, this isolation transformer, is that, in the old days, you could walk into Radio Shack and buy a part like that. Is that part conveniently available right now? And this transmitter is roughly how many watts of output that you're talking about, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
The transformer is no problem. We have over 100 pieces available, number one. Number two, if you're running it just on 140 volts, which would be just a full wave, just a half wave power supply for the power of the transformer, you get about 3 watts. If you run it with a doubler, you'll get up to about 5 to 7 watts. So it's not real high power, and you can run it at 3 watts. The beauty is, everybody will be on the same frequency. So you go on at night, you spot the receiver to the transmitter, call CQ, and chances are you'll be able to hit another Limark member.
I'm going to go over to the comment person in a minute, but first, you said there's 150 of those transformers available. Do they just happen to be in your possession, Hal, or do you know of a vendor that has 150 of these transformers sitting on the shelf at some convenient price? Over to you, Hal.
I have the transformers. Don't worry about that. All you need, Richard.
Okay, then they are really available. The person who wanted to make a comment, who was that? It sounds like Rob. Give me your call letters and name, KQRIW.
Hello, Rich, WB2GXM.
Okay, go right ahead, Rich, with your further comment.
The last comment is, Dick, I am interested in that transformer. I've been looking for a project like that for a while, so Hal, I would definitely be interested in that. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
K2UPS is on, Dick. You might want to pick him up.
Okay. Let's see. The man who was in Kentucky, then he was in Ohio, but now he's probably in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, mobile. Where are you, Rich? And give us your comments on this transmitter. And you're a QRP man from way back, so this is right up your alley. K2UPS, K2RAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick and Annette. K2UPS Mobile. I'm in Pennsylvania right now, Dick, near New Stanton, heading back to New York. I always wanted to build a small little tube QRP rig like this. That would be great. I would definitely be interested in it. I'm just wondering if he has any idea of an approximate range of cost, or let's say, like, if 20 people wanted to do it, this is about much it would cost. If 50 people wanted to do it, this is the approximate cost. I'm just curious if there's any sort of price range at all figured out, or is it really just going to depend ultimately on how many? Back to that.
I'm going to give a partial answer to that one, Rich. A logical-sounding question, but I think it's not a showstopper. No matter what the cost is, if you look at the resources that are within this club with 400 members, some of them have got fat wallets where they don't know where the hell to spend the money. And if 10 young guys in the club wanted to do this and they didn't collect enough money on their paper route, guarantee a number of members of this club would come forward and say, here's the cash, go do it. That's my guess as to what's going to happen. So the exact price, I think, almost doesn't matter. Let's see what Hal's got to say. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6D. The only thing I have to say is I want to present the documentation to the board, let the board hash it around, build up a receiver and transmitter, and then buy from there.
Let's see what Rich has got to say on this. Rich, I think whether it's $5 or $50, I guarantee it's somewhere in between. I think that doesn't matter. This club has the resources. When it comes to financing the youth, getting their fingers wet for the first time with real electronics, I don't think the price is a limiting factor. I think they can come up with a token fee where the student pays for it, but he's not really supporting the whole project. The club is supporting the rest of it. I see that as a possibility. K2UPS, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Well, I mean, I'm not looking for somebody to pay for it for me. That's not an issue myself. And you're right, price really doesn't make that much difference. I'd probably do it anyway. But there are other people I know that might be interested in this, but I was going to pass the information along, and some of them, the price might make a difference. So I was just curious at this stage. I know it's very early in the planning stages, but you know, if there was any sort of approximate range, but no problem. I would definitely be in on this, and I'll be listening for any further developments. Back to that.
Yeah, you've got guys who have loved tubes from the early days. Rich probably has a good selection of tubes. I know Hal's got a huge selection of tubes. I've got a small selection of tubes. Rich BXM probably also does. So finding a 6AQ5 and a 6U8, that's not very difficult, even though they're slightly ancient thermionic emission devices. In the old days, the bubble pack equivalent at what Radio Shack for the receiver, that's not an expensive part, so there's lots of ways to go with this one. Paul, I know you've, in the old days, probably liked tubes an awful lot, and I bet you even own some tube equipment, just like I do. WS2N, let's see what you've got to say about all this. Wait for the beeps, and you got it, Paul. K2RIW in the tech net.
2 years after Paul, think I can tell you where to get tubes. Very cheap price, brand new.
Good to know, Rich. Paul, you got it next.
WS2N, I think it's a great idea. And, I would sign up for something like that. I came in the mid-80s, Dick. You had to study about tubes for the test. And when you bought the equipment in those days, anything new was already solid state. I kind of missed the boat. I think that would be great. When you get on 40 and 80 CW, and that happens to be my favorite band, 40 and 80 CW. And you hear a guy that's running QRP. It could be a guy, you know, in Atlanta somewhere running a full gallon. And you know what? A lot of people want to go back to the guy that's doing QRP. You find that all the time. He's gonna make all the contacts. So I think it's a very good idea. Back to you, Dick WS1.
Okay, Hal. We've sent it open to the group. We've had 6 responses from 6 people. Every one of the 6 people love it. Looks to me like you got a user, or you got a loser of an idea there, Hal. I'm having some fun with him. K6DPZ, you're running 6-0 right now. You got it, Hal.
K2RIW and Technet, K6DPZ. Well, my thinking is, presenting it to Limark, I would suggest this goes on the printed circuit board, which would make it very easy for, you know, somebody who's not real familiar with circuit wiring to be able to put it all together by just putting the parts in the board and soldering the bottom of the board. Transformers printed circuit type, it drops in. Tube sockets printed circuit type, it drops in. Components will drop in. And let Limark handle the whole thing. I'm just going to create it. You guys play with it. How's that sound, Dick? K2RIW, K6DPZ.
And before you put your play on 5th Avenue in Manhattan, you try it out in Podunk somewhere. Well, you've flown this idea on the TechNet. You've let as many people who want to comment on it. You've got a response. So that as a track record to the Limark board should cut some ice. Good luck with that. I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
Counting for some quick information.
Another comment before I drop the subject.
Yeah, we're going to go to Hal and Rich in that order. Hal's going to tell us his other comment, and Rich is going to tell us where we can get a zillion tubes for free. You got it, Hal.
You're going to tell me whether I should leave or not.
Okay, the tuning of the transmitter. Any 2 neon bulbs is tuned for maximum brightness, and you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm going to go to you, Eric, and I forgot you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Where do we get tubes very inexpensively these days, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
You get the neon bulb comment.
Sure did, and I've done a lot of tuning with neon, and also with arcing to a pencil. I've done all of the above. Go ahead, Rich.
Stag, please pick up Eric. He's got a lot of good comments. Smart guy. What's smarter than me? There's a company I dealt with a lot when I was doing restoration on the Collins server in Queens called Antique Electronic Supply. Antique Electronic Supply. They're located in Tempe, Arizona. You can go online and you look them up. They've got brand new in the box tubes and other parts, capacitors, everything, that they buy up from are going out of business companies, and the tubes are brand new. They're in the box, and they're not expensive. By the way, you may want to go into some other stuff. It's a little bit of engineering, but I forget a lot of it. But I went to RCA Institute. There were two courses for electron tubes, ET21 and ET31. And I'm sure you're familiar with what I'm going to say, Dick. They taught us how to graph and draw a load line. That may be something we can teach. Back to that, and to you.
Yeah, maybe the literature on ET21 and ET31 from RCA Institute is available. Somebody like you may have it and can be copied. And the load line you're discussing, whether it's a solid-state device or a tube device, they both obey very similar characteristics along those lines. Now, the questions I had for Eric. Eric, you talked about COFDM versus 8VSB, and I think, and you're going to correct me on this one, that COFDM is the digital television technique that was selected by Europe, whereas the United States chose the 8VSB. And when it comes to the standard that we're now on, ATSC 2.0, we sort of know what that is, and I think you're saying that the ATSC 3.0 is something we're dreaming about, and I presume that's even super high resolution is my guess. So give us some words on both of those, Eric, because the people who listen to this net, they love to hear anything about broadcast. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, with only 40 years experience, K2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
K2RAW, K2J. Yes, you are correct. Europe chose COFDM. Why? Because a typical grade B that we have here, which is the coverage area that we have, in Europe, you might be transmitting into another country. Actually, the analog transmission system was such that one country would transmit negative sync, and the neighboring country would transmit positive sync. One country would have the sound carrier above the video, the other country would have the sound carrier below the video. So they made it so that they tried to contain it. There are countries in Europe that are smaller than some of our medium-sized states, so that's why they chose going that way. They operate with less power, but their coverage area is smaller, so that's the word. We require a heck of a lot of power to try and duplicate the coverage area. And on to the next subject. Okay, as you know, we are currently at ATSC 2.0, which specifies 8VSB, and the elementary streams, or the actual data that is contained in the transport stream, which is transmitted via VSB and collected in the RF, and that would sell it. And there's more stuff than that, but stop right there. That is the current system. So ATSC 3 now. ATSC 3 will actually allow for mobile or portable devices being able to be in a moving vehicle, transmitting UHD or ultra high def, which is a 4K thing. It's quite a small UHD camera. Last year, about 3 weeks ago, I was playing with it. It can actually take that output, which is 4 times the resolution of the HD, set it up on a wide shot, and you're editing, zoom in and pan and scan, do all the things that you would have done being the camera person, but now you have this huge field where you can zoom into the area of interest. You're spinning it out in standard HD, it looks perfect. Anyway, there is the change in transmission standard, which means that it might not be backwards compatible, meaning that all the stuff that you have now won't be any good, but that's what they're trying to avoid. So there's a number of different proposals that are currently on the table. Actually, not that recent, since an NAB just happened, and they had all these big meetings and everything. I haven't read the news lately, so I don't know exactly where they stand. That's sort of the idea. K2RAW, K2J.
Yeah, in the old days when your organization was a little bit richer, I think they would send you to all of these broadcast meetings, National Association of Broadcast, NAB meetings. And so now you've got to read about it because you weren't there as it was happening. When you're using a UHD, ultra-high density, ultra-high definition television, in order to transmit all of that extra data in real time, really requires either much higher encryption rate, in other words, more bits per symbol, which requires much higher signal-to-noise ratio, and or more bandwidth. I think some of these proposals would not have the transmission on one single channel, but two channels that maybe are adjacent or maybe the non-adjacent. The good news is that there's almost enough UHF channels left over that you could use two channels or maybe even three, maybe even four, in order to transmit this. But under normal circumstances, to get four times, to get the higher density, higher bit rate, means you're more vulnerable to signal-to-noise ratio, and to combine that with mobile and portable devices, it sounds to me like a bit of a conflict. To make that all come out and to have reasonable range from the broadcast center, I'm a little worried about this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. You're not forward thinking here. You know, currently with ATSC 2.0, we do have something called ATSC or HBSP M/8, M meaning mobile, H meaning handheld. Within the HBSP, we have something called enhanced DHT. Don't forget that the majority of the stuff that is being transmitted is just pseudo-random numbers. You can now replace those pseudo-random numbers with what appears to be slower, lower frequency, lower bit rate stuff, which you can now use a mobile or a handheld device with a decent equalizer in it and have it work well. And that is currently working, and that actually is available in many cities.
No, they haven't done it here. They've done it in Chicago and a few other places where it's worked quite well.
And the concept of that is that they include the decoder in your cell phone, so you can have the receiving end to end. Let's see, let me let it drop for a second. So, your concept of using multiple channels is, as you must be aware, there's another auction coming up, and we're going to auction off another, another whole 150 megahertz of the UHF band, which means that stations can now sell their frequency allocation and make money from it and not be on the air, or combine themselves with another station. And what they're going to do is repack all the stations, lower down the band, and the stuff that they sold goes to the highest bidder on the upper part of the band. So the concept of having four channels is like that ain't happening, period. And if anything, it's going to be a reduction of channels. So, currently transmits this stuff called MPEG-2 for video now on ATSC or HBSB, whatever you want to call it, in American TV digital, right? And the compression rate that we do is, we're transmitting an HD signal, starts off as 1.16 gigabits per second. And we have to squeeze it down into less than, say, 19 megabits per second. We even squeeze it down more because we might happen to have another channel or two that will lift it in there. Okay, so this compression scheme, MPEG-2, let me let it drop again. The way it works, it does a number of different things. It does a couple of compression tricks. One is run length encoding, which I think we talked about at some point in the past. It takes an 8x8 block and it does a discrete cosine transform on it, and it represents that by one wrong coefficient number. Things like that. And we pack all this stuff into less than 19 megabits, because that, in the current method of transmission of HBSD, including the TELUS and all the other stuff that make it happen, takes up 6 megahertz. Now, HGSC3
is going to work in 6 megahertz. So we got to do something different. So the stuff that you now see on your computer, which will be an MPEG-4 or MP4, but it's also known as H.264 or HVAC, which is 2 more layers of compression. It's actually, its base compression is MPEG-2 with refinements that make it MPEG-4. Actually, MPEG-4 started out as a sprite manipulator. That's a long story. Now, for UHD, we've gone 2 more steps further. We've got HVAC, which is high-efficiency video coding. And we have, and its acronym is associated with, it's now known as H.265. So, instead of a 50-to-1 compression ratio, which we're doing in HD, we're now doing a 200-to-1 compression ratio in HDTC, and we get amazing results out of it. So, the concept of, you know, stuffing this stuff into 6 megahertz, hey, it fits.
But have we done a over-the-air impulse noise and multipath vulnerability experiment? Will it really survive? What percentage of over-the-air will work? I know that there's movement to get rid of over-the-air. I think enough people are going to complain that no, you can't do that. It's too big a tradition. But associated with this was a question I've asked you before. I'm not quite sure what the modern-day answer is. You and I know I'm using a pretty ancient digital television converting box with a fairly ancient technology inside. If I had access to global positioning satellite disciplined oscillators so I could make an exact frequency for the so-called pilot signal. If my pilot signal being injected into my digital converter was known to be the exact right phase, the exact right frequency, would I still have as much impulse noise, breakup, and multipath vulnerability as I currently have, or could that possibly make some improvement on all of the above, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW. Let's just say that we could synchronize the clock that's doing all the counting in your receiver with the transmitter in a way that it never gets disturbed. So, what that means is that anything, any activity that Mother Nature provides you, or airplane or emission noise or anything like that, will show up as little speckles, but your receiver won't avalanche. It won't go to nowhere because it now has to figure out where it is, who it belongs to, what it's singing to. It's got to think about where the zero starts by counting from. As long as those clocks are running continuously, you would just see little artifacts, but it wouldn't go away on you. I mean, that would be like a huge improvement for some people, I think.
Now, that degree of frequency accuracy and spectral purity is being used by the cell phone companies today, and it's rather successful. So therefore, for the broadcast industry to synchronize their pilot tone with that accuracy, and for me to find a way to synchronize my pilot tone injection into my demodulator with that kind of frequency accuracy and spectral purity, would I then become almost invulnerable to multipath and almost invulnerable to ignition noise? In other words, instead of my receiver just saying, weak carrier, and it gives me no picture on screen and locks up, but I would continue to get audio and video with a little bit of artifacts. Is that something worth seeking? And since every cell phone to some degree is doing it, why can't our broadcast over the air television set do it? KE2EJ, K2RIW, I'm willing to pay for that.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, a couple things. First of all, the transmission standard is going to change. It still hasn't been decided whether things are going to be backward compatible, although the world seems to want it to be. But let's say that it is. One of the things about the new standard is it includes a certain improvement that supposedly is going to help this situation out. But you've got to take into consideration, when you look at a TV manufacturer
know how much they pay people to figure out, well, you can do without this 5 cent capacitor, and we can do without this and that. So already you're talking about making the cost of your converter, which got for $40, possibly doubling its cost because it needs a GPS module. And in many instances, the converter box is going to be inside the house. And yes, it does. A local antenna in the box would probably work, but in most cases, you would want to put the antenna outside. So you've now added complexity and cost, so it's something that's already complex. I know how you feel about it, but it's sort of, not necessarily broadcasted because the manufacturers kind of drive this thing. Yes, I agree with you, but will it happen? I doubt it. Detroit WK3J.
Steve, this meeting, I'm back to
you. Understand, Hal. I think there could be two paths on that broadcast receiver manufacturer. One is the Cadillac class, and the other is the Volkswagen. And a certain percentage of the population wants the Cadillac class. Occasionally, I'm one of those guys. I drive a cheap car, and I've got a cheap house, so to speak, but I don't have a cheap dollar. There are certain things. You got to put your emphasis on the right syllable. But let me combine something you said earlier, Eric. Let me drop them. To get reasonably good digital over-the-air television reception right now requires in the vicinity of 27 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio in that demodulator. And part of that restriction for that 27 dB carrier-to-noise ratio, I think, is to make sure that the pilot tone, which really is the clock to some degree, that really sets all the right bits and timing and everything. What was that again?
The only thing the pilot tone is, think of it as like AFC, okay? There's no data contained in it. It's just a carrier.
However, the accuracy of that carrier reproduced in my demodulator, does not really set all the timing for the various steps of demodulating? If my local...
No.
Okay. You're telling me that that carrier is nothing but an AGC amplitude indicating signal that... telling me that I could have a megacycle of error on that pilot tone and the rest of my demod would work correctly? Is that what you're telling me, Eric?
That thing is just a training signal for the equalizer, period. Okay. The actual data, the clock is separated. Actually, from that, you wind up getting INQ, and then you do your math and you pick out the stuff that you need. The clock occurs every, there's multiple clocks. There's the transport stream clock, which occurs every 150 milliseconds. There's the elementary stream clocks, which occur every 150 microseconds, something like that. I don't remember. But, actually, the data is driven by the sync. It's asynchronous, so it's all built into itself.
Comment before I buy the snow show.
All of these clocks, Eric, require a certain amount of timing and phase accuracy. Are you telling me all of those clocks are irrespective, that they are not related in any way to that pilot tone? Is that what you're telling me, Eric?
Yes. The pilot tone, or the training signal, was actually added later after the system was developed to try and help the equalizers do a better job.
Okay, then tell me where the accuracy of all those clocks comes from. You've got multiple clocks. In order for the timing of everything and the demodulation process to come out right, those clocks have got to be on the right frequency and probably on the right phase and the right relationship to each other. Who is generating those clocks and what being used as the raw data to generate that clock locally in my demodulator? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Okay. Firstly, I recommend you stop thinking like an analog man. A clock might actually be a special number, which it actually is. When you turn the RF into a bunch of pulses, you'll get a chain of pulses that actually might be an FE, actually is what they use for the clock. There might be a sequence of four of them. And there's a little circuit in the receiver that detects that.
and that runs an oscillator, actually runs a counter, and runs a counter which is connected to a phase oscillator.